Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. We're taking another adventure in the ORSC Lab series today. I'm your host, Leslie Morse, and along with fellow ORSC Lab member, Billy Shetpeltz, we're excited to be talking with Paul Tevis. Paul is a coach and facilitator. He partners with technical leaders who want to work as effectively with people as they do with technology. He has been in and around the Agile community since 2008 and was sort of certified in ORSC in 2016. You can learn more about him and his work at PaulTevis.com. Paul, thank you for being here today. And thanks, Billy, for joining us as well.
Yeah.
Happy to be here with both of you.
Yeah, this is, I'm really excited. I've known both of you individually for quite a while, but this is the first time we're actually really coming together as a triad. So before we dive into kind of the content for today's episode, let's spend just a couple minutes on like how we want to be together, right? As ORSCers, there's this idea of the third entity, which is almost sort of a representation of what our relationship is in the world, almost like it was a person in and of itself. So like, I just invite us to kind of dream for a minute. Like, what do we think our third entity might be like? I love the faces, right? Our listeners don't get to see faces, but just like the faces on the video right now are awesome.
I was thinking the same thing. They also can't see me nod vigorously. Because I do a lot of work over video calls, and the comment I get a lot is, "You have very high affect." And I was like, "That's true."
I think our third entity would have high affect.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Like both, all three of us, and I think collectively, we have, we're really in tune, or we're really noticing what's happening with each other a lot. Mm-hmm. I think there's a piece of our third entity which is about both noticing what's happening in us and also noticing what's happening in the system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for some reason, like Broadway Lights flashed into my mind, but I don't know how that relates to our third entity. But
no, it's a showmanship quality that resonates with me.
Yeah. There's definitely an aspect of it's out there, right? It's and when it's out there, it's something that people can react with and react to and work with.
I like that.
Yeah. Right. But it's not like grandstanding sort of showmanship. There's a
come and be with me almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Inviting sort of beacon of light.
Yeah. Yes. And so my background is in improv. And one of the things we talk a lot about is making offers, right? And in a lot of ways, our reactions to things are offers for the other person's to add to. Right, there's an invitation there of
what's
going on. What's going on with you? What's going on with us? How can we build on that?
I love that.
Yeah. And it extend it to what's going on in the world around us. There's an innate curiosity in our third entity of who are we? What can we be? What is the world? What can the world be?
Yes.
There's a thing that's coming up for me. I mean, as you said, like the three of us have all been together in one place and one time before, but I don't think we've ever really had the opportunity to be intentional about what we want to create in the world in the same way. Right. It's usually much more of a, we're hanging out and it's fun to see each other, certain things at a conference. And this is more of a like, wait a minute, what could we really do here?
I feel that energy too. Like there's potential. There's things that could happen.
Yeah, it's palpable.
Yeah.
It is. So like with this dreaming we're doing, right? What about this in what we're creating in our third entity, like has some meta skills that we really want to channel as we go through today's episode?
I think possibility is what's coming up for me. It's a weird meta skill. I don't think I've ever used that word.
Infinite possibility is sort of, when you say that, what I hear is infinite possibility.
And now I'm going to, like after this, I'm going to be pondering that as a meta skill. Because I don't know that I've ever thought about that as a meta skill.
Yeah, like that potential possibility, like what can unfold. I mean, that leads to or is connected to that sort of notion of curiosity, right? Or, we sometimes talk about inquiry advocacy, right? Where it's like, what is it that I know that I know? And what are the things where I know that I don't know? And I need to get curious about it. And I think that's going to be I think that's going to be something that's going to show up for the three of us is like, oh yeah, we got this. And then they're like, ooh, what's about to happen?
Yeah.
And being comfortable dancing back and forth between those two to explore that possibility, that potential.
For yeah, sure.
I love it.
I'm sitting with lots of wonderment.
Mm.
Which I think, right, there's a theme to all of this around possibility and curiosity and sort of this seeking of the awe and wonderment. Mm. Sort of, I love these, and it makes me really excited for digging into the conversation. Before we get there, though, because Paul, you shared with me a couple things about ORSC. You want to make sure that we get out to our listeners today. What do the two of you need from me, sort of wearing that role of host, as we move through the discussion? Anything specific you want to ask for?
Well, one of the things you're already doing is a thing I really appreciate, which is you're holding the agenda. So and remembering what the question was, because which is, you know, is kind of freeing at times because it allows me to kind of explore and go a little bit. And then I go, wait a minute, am I answering the question? And I'm trusting that you will remind us if we're not actually answering the question. So that's incredibly useful to me.
Plus one all the way.
Yeah. And what's really interesting about that for me is that that's often a role that I have to hold, right? And when I'm in a relationship, when I'm working in a group, where someone else can sit in that role, it frees me up to do other things that I may not be as used to doing, but that can be really useful, which is actually an experience I had when I was in certification that I kind of learned about that. So,
that's
yeah,
great.
Thank you. So hold it, like, keep, you know, in some ways keeping us honest about what it is we're actually trying to do is a useful role.
Yeah. And I think for me, that's going to be resisting the urges to pull on like shiny threads, because just the idea, right, that you're bringing up here, Paul, of, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I don't have to hold dual roles within our system right now. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be the facilitator and some other thing is so freeing. I believe we as agilists often get trapped in the holding of facilitator and subject matter expert at the same time, which
absolutely.
Is such a challenge. But we're not going to go there, even though we totally could.
That was one of those later strings, one of those shiny strings you're not going to pull on.
Yes, I'm just naming it because it's cool, but I'm not going to pull on it.
That'll be another podcast off to the side.
Yeah. Billy, anything you need from me today?
No, I plus one what Paul was saying. I think it's great. Right. Thank you.
Cool.
So I'll flip that. Is there anything you need from us, Leslie?
Call me if I'm pulling a thread.
Great.
All right. So thank you all for kind of doing that sort of setup. I think that's super useful. It's also a great little demonstration of how we use some ORSC tools and techniques to kind of help with sort of systems entry into a conversation, which I love. So, before we start talking about some of the tools you're passionate about, Paul, like, what attracted you to ORSC and how do you find yourself using it as an agilist?
Yeah. So I, you know, my agile journey started long, long ago. I read Extreme Programming Explained when I was working as a software engineer in probably about 2002. So, you know, not long after it was published, not long after the manifesto, you know, came out in 2001. And I went, wow, this is really amazing. I would love to work in this way. And I also, right after that, got introduced to the goal, Elihu Goldratt, Theory of Constraints. And so I've been thinking about Agile and Lean and these kinds of things basically my entire career. Though I didn't really get a chance to practice many of them until I moved into another organization in 2007, because the company that I was at the time was incredibly individually focused. Right? It was individual code ownership, very strong. You were supposed to have badass technical skills sorts of things. And the whole notion of collaboration was just kind of a foreign concept and not something that they really wanted to develop. And I had figured out through some of that work that I was really more interested in groups. Like, I was a good software engineer, but I was noticing that the problems we were having developing software were not so much about the technical challenges, but more about the how do we work effectively together challenges. So I moved into another organization where I thought I was going to go get my PMP and become a project manager. And then we had an opportunity to do an initial sort of agile pilot project. And I ended up spearheading that. And it was a great success because, of course, it had all of the characteristics that you would expect would lead to success with a project like that. It was a small, relatively well-defined scope. It was a small team. It was we were all co-located. We had subject matter experts who we could consult with right in the moment and get instant feedback. Like, it was great. And then at that organization, we did two other projects that shared none of those qualities. And the second one did not go very well, but it was already going worse. So that was okay. And then we learned, I mean, it was like, oh, this wasn't great, but it was better than the previous iteration of that had been. And then the third one was really where we really started to hit our stride and figure some things out. And it was as I was going through that transition, going from being an engineering manager into coaching and facilitation, right? That was when I, you know, did coaching agile teams with Lisa Atkins and Michael Spade and David Chilcott. And really, that was the time around the time that they were really starting to fold more of the ORS concepts into that work as how I got exposed to it. And I was doing facilitation training with a community at work in San Francisco. And I discovered that I really loved working with groups. Working one-on-one with individuals was actually really foreign to me for a long time. But groups suddenly were a thing. And when I left that organization and went and took a job as a full-time internal Agile coach, one of the things that I kind of asked for in early on in my professional development there was, hey, I've heard about this program. I've dug into it. This ORS thing I think will be really valuable for the work that we do here, because I was working with teams, and I basically sold it. My manager also went through part of the program, but really sold it to our VP that, hey, this would be really useful, and so went through it, and that was how I found it and got into it. And it turned out to be incredibly useful in the work that I was doing.
Yeah, I really love, Paul, the way you sort of describe that journey. Because one, I think it's super awesome that you went from, like, there's not enough stories about people that start kind of as engineers and end up being like people workers. So like that is possible. Like if you're sitting there listening as someone like, oh, I'm just a developer, I'll only ever be a developer. Like, that is not true. Like, infinite mm-hmm. possibility is
infinite
out there.
Possibility.
Absolutely.
But also, right, that realization of ORSC is about working with teams and systems and relationships. And as agilists, like, we are in that people business. And it's not, right, Coactive is amazing. There's so much richness to learn from that more one-on-one style coaching, but that gift and the nuance and art of how to work with teams, mm-hmm. It's so amplified through this ORSC work.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how it was for you going through the coursework, but I encountered a lot of people who, you know, felt comfortable in a one-on-one situations, but anytime you'd get to like more than the three people, they'd just be like, I don't know how to work with this.
Right. Exactly. And Paul, I do love the way you described the group thing. Was there a moment when you were like, okay, I love groups. What was the moment or the timeline where you were like, oh, and there's a system behind the group? Like, it's not just that there's more people.
Right. It's that it's that web of interactions. Right.
Yes.
So it's funny, right? There's two intro classes for the ORS curriculum. There's ORS Fundamentals and there's ORS at Work. And they're similar. They cover pretty much all the same material. One of them is really intended for people who have a coaching background. And one of them is for people who may not have any coaching background at all, who may be professional leaders or things like that. And just because of timing and the schedule, I ended up going through ORS at Work. There's a tool that they do in that called the string activity, which doesn't show up in Fundamentals. And I don't know if the two of you have ever done this activity.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, great. Yeah, so I love that as a visualization, right? You end up creating the web between the people, right?
Yeah.
That's what ORSC is about. It's about focusing. It's soft focus on the people holding the strings, and it's strong focus on the strings themselves, on the web. How do you work with that? And so that for me is the fundamental shift. I don't even know when I first really understood that. I know I got it by the time I was, you know, in Or Is It Work. Because it's, and I actually do that activity a lot with groups when I'm starting to work with them, particularly through a strong ORSC lens, because it's mm-hmm. it's such an easy way for them to get like how what we're going to do is different than what they might think it is.
Right. Right. Cause it isn't just pure facilitation and it's not just more people. It is different. Right. And I like the soft focus on the people holding the strings. We're really focusing on that web. I love that. That's a great description.
It is. And I will pull on the thread of the string, because I think there's something so beautiful about that string exercise that actually relates to sort of the way we think about Agile in teams, right? If you think about, right, there's some of the roots of Agile pairing, mm-hmm. right? You know, two people, each with their own string, right? In that activity, you start as pairs. And then, right, pairs can join together to form teams. Then teams join together to form programs. And programs join together to form portfolios in our enterprises. So as agilists that are facilitating things like the string exercise, you can layer in those sort of classic agile examples to really drive home the systems awareness and learning that is possible.
Yeah. And one of the things that is interesting for me in there is that we, you know, it's not just adding more people, right? There is a feeling as groups get larger that the individuals get lost in them. And yes, that is kind of true, but also you can still tap into that notion of voices of the system where it's like, hey, individuals can still, like, do still matter because they are channels for these various different voices to come out. And we need in organizations to provide methods to get at that wisdom, right?
Yes.
That when we just aggregate stuff and average things in these large organizations, we lose that systems view, right? We get an aggregate rather than system.
Yeah, or we're optimizing for the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, it's a lower fidelity way of interacting with a system.
Yeah. And I've never thought about mod programming, Leslie, but when you were talking about how the pair programming, I'm like, oh, mod programming is basically the wisdom of the system, the voice of the system at the keyboard.
It is. If anything, right, mod programming is the third entity writing the product.
When done correctly.
Yes, absolutely. When done correctly, yes.
I say that in part because I actually recently did a workshop in an organization that does a lot of mob programming where I was doing ORSC tools with them. I was introducing the whole concept of relationship systems intelligence. So we did the string exercise, we did constellation, we were doing these things. And what was interesting is I got the sense that it helped them name things that were happening when they were mobbing, but that they didn't have a vocabulary for.
Yeah. I mean, it's that ORSC competency reveal the system to itself.
Absolutely.
Right? That is what this is all about.
Yeah.
And I will say it wasn't at all intimidating to go into an organization that does a lot of mob programming and try and teach them things about relationship systems, you know, because I figured what is it that I have to teach? And instead it was again, not really giving them anything they didn't already know, but it was helping them understand it in a way that they hadn't before, that they could now take advantage of that.
Yeah, exactly. Once they understand that, then they're going to go even further, right? Like that's the infinite possibility again. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Paul, when we were prepping in a chat yesterday, before this episode, we were talking about sort of two of your most used and favorite ORSC tools, Informal Constellations and Lands, which I know Billy 100% loves. And they really tie well to this theme that we're talking about of revealing the wisdom of the system, allowing people to take the inherent knowledge and wisdom they already have, see it through a different lens, and actually like create more from the place of their relationship with each other. So like, what is it like, because I think we need to do a little education for listeners as well, right? Sure. On what informal constellations and lands are.
Yeah.
So like, talk to us about like what these are, why you use them, like do a little of that education for us.
Sure. So part of the reason I love both of these tools is they involve physicality. They involve actually using physical space. So I now do a lot of facilitation in virtual space, and I was resistant to that for years, because there are, like, when we actually get together all in the same place at the same time, there are so many rich tools to us that unfortunately so many groups don't use effectively, and that actual use of the space is one of them. And so I try to whenever I am facilitating a group and work and coaching a group in person, I try to use as much of the actual fact that we're together as possible. And so Constellation, informal Constellation, is one of these. It's probably my favorite and one of my most used.
I wish people could see like the love on your face when you're just talking about this. It's so beautiful.
Well, the thing is, I'm doing one today with a client. So I'm tapping back into this. So both of these, because I do a lot of work, particularly with larger groups. And as we kind of said, like in larger groups, it's really easy to lose a lot of the wisdom, right? Things get filtered out, things get aggregated out, things like that. And these are both tools that I feel that I can comfortably use with larger groups. How large? I have facilitated an informal constellation with 120 people, which was awesome. And I'll tell the story about it in a minute. And I've done lands work with, I think it was about 80. But the important thing about lands work is the number of different lands, the sort of subgroups within the group that you're working with. And and more than five starts to get untenable. But it was a case where it was a software engineering group, and the lands that we identified were actually functional roles. And they had about five different roles that showed up. And so we kind of aggregated them into that. But so those are both ways of bringing out multiple perspectives, voices of the system that maybe not getting heard or listened to, but really creating a space for all of them to come forth so that we can create new awareness from which to plan. Both of them do that. They do them in slightly different ways.
Yeah. And so, I think with informal constellations, it's the fact that so much knowledge comes from out without even actually using words. The safety that is possible there, right? People don't need to speak. They just need to move. Yeah. And that tends to be safer in edgy situations.
Yeah. So with the big informal constellation we did, this is when I was an internal coach, and we were doing it was in January, it was a big kickoff. And so we had all of the product development organization together at a hotel to do our kickoff sort of thing. And the sort of chief architect was laying out the technical vision for the next year. These are the ways we need to kind of grow the technology. These are the things we want to move away from, we want to move towards, you know, and so he lays this out. And when I say I facilitated it, I was partnering with someone at the time, Heidi Helfand, who was my boss at the time. We were working together, and we had been charged by our VP, hey, we really want to understand the degree to which people are clear about and buy into this technical vision. And so we'd been told a few weeks in advance, like, design something, we'll do that. And we just said, cool, let's do an informal constellation.
So perfect. Simple, elegant way to do it.
Absolutely. And so the chief architect kind of lays out, this is what the vision is going to be. And, you know, it's like a 30, 45 minute, you know, slideshow, you know, presentation sort of thing. Like, cool. And then we take everybody into the ballroom next door. Nice. And it helped that Constellation was, and variations on informal Constellation were something that Heidi and I did a lot of in that organization. So people were already, probably half the people had experienced it or something like it before. So it wasn't a totally foreign concept.
That's a good tip, right?
Like, and it was great because when we said, so what we want to do, and we've got this huge hotel ballroom with this circle of 120 people around it. It was also, because we had the opportunity, we did this, I'm remembering right now, we actually asked people to line up in a line in order of how long they'd been at the company.
Oh, cool.
And just doing that revealed the system to itself.
Yeah.
It was really, and we had them doing that while we were like doing the rest of the logistics, getting everything set up. So we make them around into a circle, right? I said, okay, so we're going to do a constellation here. And like, six people just start cheering. We're like, okay, we cannot fail. There's no way we can fail with this right now. But so the idea is, right, you have an object that is the center of the universe, right? And you put that in the middle. All right. And then you say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to ask a series of questions. And in informal constellation, it's usually three, and they're structured in a particular way. And I actually, that's one of the things that I love about the tool is the crafting of those questions to get.
It's also the hardest part.
It is.
As the facilitator and coach.
Yeah.
Is to not ask those in leading ways that have implicit bias or right and wrong within them.
Yeah. Yeah. And also you want to take it, you want there to be an arc, right? That leads through like awareness and reflection out into action. You want them to go on a journey, but you don't want to influence the direction of their journey. Mm-hmm. So we line them up and we say, how well do you understand the vision of that's just been laid out? And the more you understand it, stand closer to this object, the less you understand it, you stand further away. Right. And so it's just, we want to know how well do people understand it? And, people move around and they sort of arrange themselves. And then, we do the kind of, we ask for a few voices, let's hear from a couple of voices that are near the center. Why are you standing where you're standing? And what is it like for you to be there? Because you're just revealing, right? And then you go further out, and you just, and everybody can hear. It's the whole point is this is the system talking to itself, right? It's the group hearing all of these things. Mix it up, move around. And then the second question was how committed to this vision, or how much do you believe that this is the right direction to go?
Oh, nice.
Wow. Right. And there are things that I would do differently knowing what I know now about how you do alignment around these things. But it was just kind of what level of reservation do you have about following this vision, right? And then so that was the next level. And we do the same thing, right? Voices in, voices further out. And then the last level was, how clear are you about what you can do to support the vision?
Oh, right?
Like how, because, and that's the moving to action step. And then, people do that. And then you pair people up and say, what's important to you about this last position? And what's something that would help you hold, have this intention, right? You can do some different things with it. Yeah. But that was kind of what we did. And it was like, honestly, the simplest, like best thing that came out of that was in the first round where we asked, how clear is this? You've got standing right in the middle is the guy who just presented it, right? Of course he's totally clear on it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then around him are all of the engineering directors who, of course, have been working with him on this vision for the last 3 months. And then a ways away is everybody else, right?
Oh,
they've just
so
seen it for the first time. And so one of those directors came to me afterwards and he said, I guess it makes sense that we're really clear on this and everybody else still has a lot of questions about it. And it's one of those things that's kind of obvious, but no one had to say that, right? He looked around and he went, oh, right. I guess we still have some work to do here around this. Like there were other useful things that came out of it, but that was the one where it was just
it almost like that sort of, I guess, cliche of, a picture's worth 1,000 words. It's almost like an informal constellation is worth 1,000,000 meetings.
Because
you can get so much more knowledge.
I mean, so that, again, going to your thing about you don't have to, you almost didn't need anybody to say why they were standing where they were standing. We almost didn't need to talk once we got to that arrangement. That said, my experience with informal constellation is that those debriefing questions are really valuable because we will make up a story about why someone is standing where they're standing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that story is completely wrong. Particularly the how is it for you to be standing there question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I did one around at one point where oftentimes the second and third questions are like, how involved have you been in this and how involved do you want to be in this?
Oh.
So it's like, I did one recently where it was around some turnover, like some people had left the company, and that had led to some shakeups and some turmoil, like in team membership and things like that. And so the team asked, like, we want to do something around this. And I was like, oh, Constellation would be great, right? And so the first question was, how concerned are you about the turnover and turmoil? And then the second question was, how involved in dealing with this have you been? And the third one is, how involved do you want to be in working with this? And, you know, it was interesting because there were some people who were, you know, and then moving from that second to that third position is really powerful, because you get to say, like, I've been dealing with this and I don't want to, or, mm-hmm. you know, I'm really concerned and I haven't been involved. I didn't even know that being more involved was a choice. Like,
That's cool.
Yeah. And so that was really useful, because again, that becomes new information for everyone to work with in terms of how to plan.
Paul, I love how quick you are at these questions. And so for the people that are listening, are you just magical, or do you spend some time
prepping? No. I spend a lot of time with those, right? Because with informal Constellation, because of how rich it is, it really, my experience is it works best with three questions. And so that's that arc that I'm talking about, is the, like, if I'm thinking about what is the outcome that the group is trying to get to, without telling them that there is, while still making it true that there is no wrong place to stand.
Mm-hmm. And that's really the most important thing around the container you're creating as coach.
Yep.
There
yep.
is no wrong place to stand.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's no wrong place for anyone else to stand either. Mm-hmm. And
do you hold no crosstalk? Do you allow crosstalk, or do you hold the no crosstalk?
I hold no crosstalk pretty strongly. Right. So this, I say things like, and what's interesting, like, I've noticed as my evolution as a coach and facilitator happens, like, I have a much better sense of when a thing is just getting said and that's okay and I can let it go, as opposed to, I actually need to address this right now because otherwise it's gonna move towards stuff. Whereas I used to just be like, no talking. Right. I used to be very, very harsh on that. And now I think that's because a lot of my RISC work, I'm listening to the system at a deeper level. So I can tell, when is this a violation of the rules that's actually okay? And that if I actually clamp down on it, the system's going to rip my arm off.
Well, you don't want the system to spit you out as coach.
No.
Especially in the middle of an activity that could
absolutely cause
lots of strife.
Right. I need to stay in relationship with them. Right. And so, like, recognizing where that kind of is. The other thing that I've started to do a lot of is the language that I used to use a lot around this is a place of no judgment. And I've gotten to this point of recognizing, like, that's not possible.
We are all judgment making machines.
We're all judging.
Let's just acknowledge judgments in the system.
And exactly. And so what it is that I actually have them do is they say, so what I actually want you to do is notice what judgments you're making. And set them aside, like, hold them lightly. Notice that you're judging them, and that's okay, right? You're going to do that. That's natural. And also notice it and set it aside, and still don't let your judgment get in the way of your curiosity. In fact, maybe get curious. Maybe get curious about why you're judging it.
Which makes me think about 2% truth, right?
Absolutely.
But another ORS concept that this is, maybe this judgment's actually really something about me and not the other person.
Yeah. And so that's a place where, like, even if I were to say no crosstalk, no judgment, like, that's a judgment on my part.
Yeah.
it's like, I'm actually trying to model much more of the behavior that I'm wanting them to do. So Constellation is one of my favorites, where the team that I'm working with today is a very similar situation where, they're laying out some vision and strategy for 2020. And we want to check in, like, what's the degree of alignment? Like, how committed to executing on this vision are people? And what reservations do we still have, that they still have, that they need to work through in order to be able to move forward with it?
Yeah. I think that is such a wonderful illustrative example of really, right, the business reason for why to use informal constellations, the power that it has in the role of coach, right? Some of the things that you need to watch out for and pay attention to, when to sort of stick to the framework and when you can kind of play with the framework itself. You know, kind of, I know you're also really passionate about lands, but sort of in an interest of time, I'm mm-hmm. going to like what's a commercial for lands? Like, we've got like sort of a 90-second bit in between, you know, TV shows or whatever it is. Like, what is that about lands?
So lands work is where there are sort of identifiable subgroups within a group. And you recognize that the subgroup, the land that people come from, influences the way they see a particular issue or situation. And you want all those perspectives to come out in a way that creates empathy within the group, so that people can start to understand, hey, it's not that this other person is the problem, it's that they have a different perspective, and that perspective is shaped by whatever feature it is about the organization or the group and things like that. And so once we start to understand that, we can develop mutual empathy. I, in particular, have enjoyed it around things that have gone wrong, where there's a lot of blaming. I've used it a lot to reduce blaming and increase empathy.
Yeah. And I think if we just want to give sort of a quick example, when we're thinking about kind of classic lands we deal with as agile coaches, especially working early in agile adoption journeys, it could be things like functions you mentioned earlier, things like QA versus architecture versus database versus visual design, like some of those classic kind of disciplines of technology and product development are perfect starting places for lands.
Yeah. And another one is actually, particularly in an organization that's changed substantially over time, is when you joined the company can be a land. Like, I actually talked about how when we were doing Constellation, we lined people up because you can recognize that there are significant points in a company's evolution that are boundaries between temporal lands. You know, before the acquisition and after the acquisition, before the IPO and after the IPO, those kinds of things.
Yeah, which is the perfect, right? Using that temporal based sort of landing is that great segue into, you know, things like original myth, which is another one of the great worst tools that helps kind of ground and identify that land they're within.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. And if our commercial for lands had a tagline, it'd be like, be an empathetic tourist, or don't be an American tourist. Not to be.
We do get tagged with that sometimes as Americans, being great tourists.
Yeah.
I love it.
There's judgment in that, and we can hold it lightly.
Yeah, exactly.
2%
truth. 2% truth. 2% truth is true. So the... I also like how you talked about lands in relation to failure. And so Billy and I are going through the Oak cohort of certification and when with ORSC, and when we did our residential, the overwhelming sort of memory of the weekend was this like, ta-da, sort of like failure moment. Like
failure
when you
bow.
Did something and your hands go up in the air and you kind of squat a little bit and you're like, ta-da, I totally screwed that up. I think failure stories are such a wonderful way of learning. So like, is there a quick crash and burn as an ORSC coach that you want to share with us?
So it's not, you know, it's one of those things that, so here's the challenge. So one of the things that came up when I was in certification and going through supervision. Supervision is such a fantastic tool, right? So So you're taking recordings of coaching that you're doing with groups and having a mentor coach work through them with you and evaluate like how well are you actually doing these things. And one of the things that came up for me over and over again is that I, as a coach, I was so, and this makes sense, right? Was so concerned about my team, the group that I was working with, seeing me as competent, that I would not actually leave room for them to really do what they needed to do. Right? I was taking up too much space. And so it wasn't a crash and burn in the sense that like, I never let them go close enough to the danger for them to be able to crash and burn. I actually played so safely and conservatively with them. But what that did is it prevented them from actually getting the real value out of doing the work. So it's a subtle crash and burn, right? It's like they never recognized that it was going that way, but it was a thing that showed up kind of over and over again in a bunch of my supervision calls. And so that's actually for me, when I talk about, and I reflect on doing that more recent constellation where I thought, it's like, I have to stay in relationship with this system, but it is naturally creative intelligent, right? I wasn't really living in that space, right? I was facilitating more than I was really coaching. And it's very interesting for me because I just feel completely different now when I'm actually coaching a system and coaching.
It gives me a little bit of hope. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so much less work.
Oh, right? Cool.
Because you really are.
It takes the pressure off of you.
It absolutely does. I've talked, there's a fellow leadership coach here in Santa Barbara where I live. And she talks a lot about post-heroic leadership. And that led to a lunch conversation that we had about post-heroic facilitation.
Oh, I love that.
because oftentimes as facilitators and as coaches, like we fall into that, it's my responsibility mode. I need to blah mode. If they don't get a good result, that's my fault mode. And letting go of that. Right. Embracing kind of, I do a lot of open space works, right? And the notion that in open space, that whatever happens is the only thing that could happen. Mm-hmm. And just saying, I'm going to do what it is that I think is useful. I'm going to dance in the moment with things as they develop. And I'm not going to worry what they think about me. Yep. Because by doing that, I'm bringing focus on me. And I am not the focus when I'm working with a group. They are the focus.
Yeah, Paul, that is such, as we're moving to wrap up today, such a beautiful illustration of, I think, two of the cornerstones, right? Hold system as client, right? It's not about you. It is about their relationship system. That's the client. As well as the relationship system is creative and intelligent. Yep. Right? It's that, creative, intelligent, and whole. Like it has everything it needs there in and of itself. And we're simply, as ORS coach, there to help sort of reveal it and create the container where they can work with it. So like that's a wonderful, wonderful illustration of that.
You know, it was funny. A month or two ago, I was assisting with the ORS fundamentals class, and I realized it had been 5 years since I'd taken fundamentals. And I ended up sitting in on one of the activities because we needed to balance numbers out around. And so the instructors asked me to sit in. And so I did one of the tools with them. And somebody looks at me and is just like, that was really good. And I was like, this is what 5 years of doing this and going through certification does. This doesn't happen overnight, right? And it was, it's a long journey. And it's a long journey of like recognizing for me where I needed to get out of my own way. But it means that now I get to do this work that I absolutely love. And that isn't, there's a lot of work in the prep, right? In that, like, how do I make sure that I'm thinking about the right things ahead of time? I'm crafting these things. But then in the room, it's not all sunshine and roses and puppy dogs,
right?
But it's a different kind of work. And it's really wonderful. And I'm so glad that I found this work.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul, for being here. Billy, before we close today, I'm super curious, like what's been like one like aha or insight moment you've had as we've been chatting with Paul today?
Oh my gosh, there's been so many. I don't think I could even just pick one. Paul, I love your storytelling, and you are so generous with your knowledge and your learnings and your authenticity. So just thank you for everything you shared. I am personally going to go back and listen to it again because there's so many learnings.
Well, and I think I've said this to you before. This is valuable for me too because I am very much an external processor, right? I learn by hearing myself say stuff. So I've learned stuff while I've been through this. Right? So thank you for creating the environment that allows me to talk about, myself and the work that I love, because not a lot of people get an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And the passion exudes so completely. I know we didn't, right? Your two big things for today were informal constellations and lands. I think we got like doctoral thesis quality content on informal constellations today. I think it was perfect. Faith Fuller would be proud. You know, so we didn't quite get to lands as much. So I apologize.
Okay with that. Yeah, not a problem. I have less to say about lands.
So, but I am curious, right? We talked about meta skills like wonderment and infinite possibility and this idea of kind of curiosity. Like, how do we feel like those showed up in today's discussion? How did we do with those meta skills?
Yeah, I think they did for sure.
Yeah. It, for me, there's definitely that place of like, going back and looking at stuff in the past and going, well, wait a minute, what was really going on there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's great. And I love the warmth of our third entity and the ease and sort of natural grace that it has as well. We didn't use those words at the beginning to describe it, but I think experiencing this kind of 45-minute chat with the three of us, like that's how I feel. I hope but our listeners feel it and everything. So thank you both so much for stepping into this today.
Thank you for facilitating it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And thank you for listening to this episode of the ORSC Lab series on Agile Uprising. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. I invite you to follow the hashtag ORSC, O-R-S-C, on Twitter to be part of the conversation and subscribe to the Agile Uprising podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast.